A former prosecutor remembers the cocaine cowboy days of Miami. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Richard Gregory is the former U.S. attorney in South Florida who took on some of the most infamous South American drug lords. He was also key to the arrest of Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega. Prepare for some interesting stories. Plus, Charlie Min follows tragedy. He's a filmmaker who's worked on projects that focus on mass shootings like those in Las Vegas, Parkland, and his new project on the Pulse nightclub shooting. But he focuses on the victims, not the perpetrators. But first, Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour, is back in her hometown of Miami. We are co-moderating the Democratic gubernatorial debate in Miramar tonight. We'll talk about what drives politics in South Florida. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, the latest poll has former Miami Beach Mayor Philip Levine ahead of all other Democratic candidates in this year's gubernatorial race. The former businessman turned Miami Beach politician has a double-digit lead over the next closest opponent, former Representative Gwen Graham. Levine, Graham, Andrew Gillum, and Chris King will take part in the Florida Freedom Forum for the gubernatorial Democratic primary. The two-hour debate will start at 7 o'clock, and it's being held at the Miramar Cultural Center. It's being put on by SEIU Florida. Now, the two moderators for the event include Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour, and, of course, myself. Now, we started our conversation with Yamiche, asking her about how she felt, what it was like to return home to South Florida.
It's really exciting. I am really interested in the politics of this place because a lot of the people that I love live here. I know a lot about the issues in terms of what people really care about because my friends are trying to buy homes. My mom's retiring. So there's all these different things that I think are going on in people's lives that keep me wedded to Florida. And I just got married here. So I also feel like Florida is always going to be home. So I'm super, super excited.
You know, one of the things I noticed too is like having grown up in South Florida and then leaving from time to time and career takes you different places is in coming back and seeing it just changes so fast.
Yes, it changes very, very quickly. I was actually, when I was looking at my venue when I was getting married at Jungle Island, I was driving through downtown and I started realizing that gentrification was touching South Florida. And it's kind of, it's one thing when you see other cities that you live in, like I've been in New York and I've been in D.C., and those places change and you kind of think, okay, well, this is what gentrification looks like. When it's happening in your own backyard and when you see the elementary school that you went to surrounded by new condos, you're like, wait, this is completely different. So it's, in some ways it's sad, but in some ways, of course, it's exciting to see the city kind of get the due that it needs. I think Miami's a beautiful, beautiful place. So it's exciting to see that people are investing here. I know when I left college and wanted to come back here, it didn't work out mainly because of the job situation. There were not that many jobs in South Florida when I wanted one. So to think that the state is now attracting people from other states to come here.
So as these politicians come down to South Florida, you know, how should they approach this region? The voters here, well, I mean, it's different than you will find in most other parts of the state.
I think having really spent all my time in South Florida, you should approach these people knowing that they're very, very smart and that they're living with the issues that they're talking about. So when you're doing an interview about collective bargaining, you have to understand that you're dealing with people who might have had an illness where their union had to step up for them. You're dealing with teachers who had to make do and buy supplies. You're dealing with and had to buy supplies and kind of make their classroom a better place without having all the backing and support that they wish that they would have. You're also dealing with people who are very connected with other countries. So not only are you thinking about the fact that people want to make money to survive for their own families, a lot of people are sending money back. I'm Haitian and I grew up in a household where you were constantly talking about the cousin who you had to buy shoes for. You're sending money back for Haiti, for people schooling. People want to adopt a child in Haiti. So there's all this idea that people aren't just thinking about money for the then and the here and now. They're thinking about generationally, how does my family thrive in this situation?
You covered President Trump's campaign. You covered Bernie Sanders' campaign. The most memorable thing that you could take from your time in covering the campaigns in 2016?
The most memorable thing I can remember is the raw emotion of both candidates. I remember when I started covering Bernie Sanders, women and young girls were crying in the audience because they were so moved by what Bernie Sanders was saying to them. And he was saying something that he had been saying for a really long time, but he was saying there is the people see you, that you really do deserve to have health care, that you really do deserve to be able to go to college and then get a job. Kind of plain talking things that you think people understood. But they're things that Bernie Sanders was saying in a way with such raw passion that people were moved. I remember I covered Donald Trump the last week of the election, and we were going out to North Carolina to some really, really small town. And everyone was like, why is he going to this place? And we showed up and it was like 10,000 people standing in a field, kind of in the dark, waiting to hear Donald Trump's name and cheering his name. And it was the same kind of emotion. It was this idea that people were not just tied to the policies that were kind of vague still a week before the election, but that people were so tied to the personality of the man. Those two things I will never really forget.
So coming back to what you said a moment ago, is it now we're really more tied to personality? That we want to see somebody we think is more genuine, isn't just giving us sound bites, the typical politician?
I think people, you think about President Obama, I think a lot of people were tied to his personality. A lot of people thought of the idea of hope being not just his policies that were in some ways policies that the Clintons had also kind of championed, but they were also looking at him as a hope that this is an African-American man with this mixed race background, and people saw themselves in him in both races. So I think that we've had this idea of personalities for a while. But I think what we saw in Donald Trump and in Bernie Sanders was that people saw people that were also not as politician. They were not as polished. I would argue that President Trump was a very polished person. He was a very classy guy. He was someone who you felt like had thought really, really long and hard about all the things that he was saying. When it came to Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, they were giving thought into their speeches. But I think that they were also they felt like they were talking off the cuff, that they were kind of being real with you. And I wrote a story about how Bernie Sanders, even though he was still delivering a stump speech and he would repeat the same jokes and kind of say the same lines, that it felt so much fresher than a regular politician. So I kind of had this dichotomy of a speech for Bernie Sanders. Like, he's going to start off with a joke about climate change in China, and then he's going to go to this, and then he's going to go to that. But people kind of ate it up because it felt realer.
So we come into this gubernatorial race, and I'm wondering, how much do you think Trump is going to play in this race? In Florida,
I think that Donald Trump is on the ballot in all 50 states. Even though he's not going to be physically on the ballot, I think the elephant in the room is going to be on the back of people's mind. Do you want someone that's in the party of Trump, which is what the Republican Party is now, or do you want someone that's going to fight Trump? From what I can tell from these candidates, while they're obviously focused on themselves now because it's primaries and we're going to be talking to the Democratic gubernatorial candidates, At the end of this, they're kind of attacking Rick Scott, but they're also through that vehicle also attacking Donald Trump. So I think that that's going to be on the back of people's minds.
All right. So we look at Florida. It's been dominated by Republicans, both in the House and Senate, as well as the governor's house for a long time. But we keep hearing this thing about a blue wave this year. It's the midterms, and we tend to see voters go the other way in midterms. You have two Republicans and, four Democrats that we're going to be talking to. Is there really a blue wave, or is it just what we expect in the midterms?
I'm not sure. I think that when you talk to people anecdotally, there feels like there's a blue wave because so many more people are dialed in. So many of my family members, some of whom didn't vote in a swing state in an important state like Florida, that are now talking about James Comey's testimony and know exactly all the ins and outs of the latest political book. So there are people I think are more tuned in, but Florida is still, at least Florida in terms of state politics, is a solidly red place. So if the Democrat is able to win the governorship, that's going to be a big sign for 2020.
Let's look at some of the issues that are going to come up, that have come up. In this last legislature, we saw gun control take center stage, sadly because of the Parkland tragedy. But we saw this group of kids and their parents and supporters come to Tallahassee and really push lawmakers. And Governor Scott, who has tried to stay away from this issue and was a friend of the NRA, signed a law that now the NRA is suing against. But we think about gun control. How big a role do you think that's going to play? And how much more do you think you're going to see the NRA in this election?
I think gun control is going to be a huge issue, and I think it's going to be because of those students at Parkland. I used to debate at Fort Lauderdale High School, and I used to go to Stillman Douglas High School, and I remember just thinking as a kid, I can't imagine the voice that these kids have found and the power that they've been able to wield. These are kids that are obviously not playing around. These are kids who have experienced the terror of gun violence. And the fact that Rick Scott is listening to them tells me that, yes, he also might be moved, but that he also feels that there's probably a political shift tied to these kids, and he wants to be on the right side of that as well. Obviously, he's not running for re-election, but there's this idea that I think Republicans don't want to. They realize that I think they're going to have to approach this issue differently than they have in the past.
Another issue, of course, not one brought up by Republicans that much, but climate change and sea level rise. It almost feels like it depends on not just the party, but the geographic region. I mean, people in South Florida and even Republicans down here understand that it's an issue, and it's something that we're dealing with already, where a lot of Republicans further north, it's just not. And there was the controversy in past couple of years where Governor Scott and his cabinet wouldn't even mention the word climate change. But, you know, you could see Democrats bringing it up and then Republicans just trying not to talk about it. But is this an issue that will have any legs in this election?
I think it's going to probably be split geographically as it has been in the past. As someone who grew up in South Florida, not only do people talk about it from a kind of changing of the neighborhoods, but there's this idea that, at least anecdotally, and I know I've talked to some experts that say that the storms are getting stronger. So when you think about the fact that you're living in South Florida and you're having to kind of rebuild every single hurricane season, it's in the back of people's minds if you're a Republican or a Democrat. I lived through Hurricane Andrew, and that definitely changed my perspective on kind of what Mother Nature can do to a neighborhood. I'm thinking about Homestead, and even now when I drive through it, I have flashbacks to Hurricane Andrew. So I think that there's people that understand that, but up north, maybe, and I would say maybe because of the geographical differences, they don't think the same way. And also because it's tied to industries, right? Like the president has been talking about the fact that he hasn't, I guess, blatantly been saying that climate change is a terrible thing or a thing that's completely made up, even though there's some in the past he said that it was a hoax made up by the Chinese. But there's this idea that there's an industry, oil, energy, all this, there's money tied to kind of denying that climate change is happening. So that could factor into people's kind of thoughts on that topic.
Let's talk about this fifth candidate who will not be at the debate that we're co-moderating, Jeff Green, the billionaire from Palm Beach County. What do we know about him? What do you know about him?
I know very little about him. What I do know is that he has a lot of money, and that money could mean that he could buy ads and that he could become very familiar with voters. But last I checked, at one point he was in, and we were just discussing this, that he was in an exploratory mode. I'm not sure what that means. I don't know if that means that he's going to become this dark horse that people are going to want to vote for later. I've covered two people that people thought were not going to be able to win, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Both of them did very well. So, I mean, in some ways, anything could happen.
We're talking with Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour and a Miami native, and she's going to be joining me. We are co-moderators at this year's Florida Freedom Forum for the gubernatorial Democratic primary. It's going to be a two-hour debate that starts at 7 o'clock. It's going to be held at the Miramar Cultural Center, and it will be streamed live at WLRN.org. You know, I want to come back to this question of the Trump White House and your experience in covering Trump and the fact that really he kind of just threw the book out and just did what he wanted to do, and it forced other politicians to have to play his game. Are we living in a new era of politics because of that?
Well, there are some experts that talk about this idea that Obama made way for Trump in that Obama was this young candidate who had not spent a whole bunch of time in the Senate, which was kind of the playbook back in the day, and that he was able to be successful. And then you have Donald Trump, who I call him the reality TV president, in that he was someone that even though everyone said, oh, he's not really known, he's not a very known, well-known politician, he had been in people's living rooms for years. So I think, and then he got away with so much stuff, right? Where, like, I won't list all the different scandals for all the people at home, but there's this idea that he's kind of Teflon. And it's because he's brash, and it's because his voters think of him as this guy that's a wild card. One of his supporters once told me that he voted for him because he had a hot hand, that he just kind of looked like he was the cooler one, the one that the media was paying attention to. So I think there are also people that want to be the hot hand. They want to be the voter, the politician that people are talking about. They want to be brash. They want to kind of go with their gut. They don't want to listen to political consultants. And for some people, that might work. But let's remember that Marco Rubio tried to attack the president and tried to talk about the size of his hands, and that went really badly for him. He's still a senator, but he definitely didn't become president.
You know, just before we finish up, you were in Montreal for the G7 summit. So we talk about Trump and the way that he, you know, basically runs his business. And tell us just briefly what happened up there.
Well, what happened was that on the American side, first, President Trump was late to almost every single meeting. There was reporting that he didn't really want to go to the G7 because he didn't really see that there was really a purpose for him there. He wanted to be preparing for his Singapore summit with the leader of North Korea. But when he got there, finally, an hour and two hours late, he had really tough, intense meetings with our allies. And these are mainly because he's had these aluminum and steel tariffs that on Canada and the European Union countries. And people were very angry at that. And for the most part, that really nothing was resolved. They were able to at least when he left at 10:30 on Saturday, which was earlier than the summit ended, they were able to at least say, okay, we're going to have a joint statement. And then by the time he was on the flight, he decided to say, actually, no, I don't have that support, because the Prime Minister of Canada came out and said, well, we're not going to be pushed around by the U.S. So what you really had was the U.S. backing out of its leadership role in the G7, and the president saying, I don't really have to deal with you people. I can go about this all on my own. And I can make kind of decisions the way I want to. And our allies are saying, hey, if you want to do that, we can also figure out a way to work without you.
Going into tonight's debate, what should the candidates be thinking about what they show the voters? These are three well-known people. And then you have Chris King, who's lagging behind in the votes. And then you have Philip Levine, who's from Miami Beach. But what should they be showing tonight? What do you expect is going to happen tonight?
That question makes me think of my mother, who's been working in public schools in Miami-Dade County for more than 30 years. She's someone who wants to hear that a politician cares about her, that a politician understands struggling without making as much money as you want to make, that person understands that there's a generational issue here in Miami-Dade County, that you're having people have kids and then having to move to other states to get jobs, which is what happened with my family, because I know my mom would love for me to be living in South Florida. So I think that if I'm a politician, if I was someone that was preparing, I would want to be focusing on why did I run, what makes me connect to voters in a very personal way. Of course, you're going to have a platform, but to be honest, a lot of these candidates, some of them at least, have very similar platforms. So it's really what's going to make you stand out is whether or not you can be genuine. And if you can, of course, answer our questions.
You have a former mayor of Miami Beach. You have Andrew Gillum, who's the mayor of Tallahassee, but he's from South Florida. And then Gwen Graham, who is a representative from South Florida, and of course the daughter of a well-known and beloved by a lot of people, former governor and senator. What do you think these candidates have to do to sell themselves? They already have these big names. And right now, according to the last poll, Philip Levine has the biggest lead. But I mean, you know, moving forward, I mean, with a couple of months left before the primaries, is it just attack the person in the lead, or is it something else?
I think it's really about selling yourself to people who have a stake in South Florida, who care about South Florida. It's going to be about differentiating yourself from your candidates, but I don't think it's about attacking other people. I think it's going to be about, do people feel like you care about them? I go back to my mom because I think about her so much. She's someone who's worked in the public school for 30 plus years. She's part of a union. She's also someone who's raised kids here. She's also someone who had to see her daughter go to another state because the economy in Florida wasn't such that I could get a job here. So what you want is someone who's going to explain, look, I understand what your family's going through, and here's my plan for making your life better.
But do you think that they have to show more aggressiveness? The Democrats have to show more aggressiveness.
I think it doesn't have to be aggressive as much as it's you have to point out why you're the better person, of course. So if you're talking to someone or talking about an issue and you know that your opponent has a weakness or just has a different opinion than you, then you should really lay that out. So don't just say, at least if you're for the legalization of personal use of marijuana, remind everyone else that another candidate actually thinks it should just be for medical marijuana. If you have a idea for creating schools or creating a minimum wage, if you believe in a $15 minimum wage and someone else believes it should only be $13, and you should just point that out. I don't think that being Trump is going to help anyone other than Trump. We've seen other people try to be him, and it hasn't worked out. You think about Roy Moore in Alabama. You think about Marco Rubio right here in Florida. Those people tried to kind of persevere and try to be kind of nasty to people, and it didn't work out. So I think Donald Trump is still kind of being very successful in his brand of politics, but I don't think everyone can do that.
And again, that was Yamiche Alcindor, White House correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Again, you can hear tonight's debate with four of the Democratic gubernatorial candidates on WLRN starting at 7 o'clock. It's going to be streaming online at WLRN.org. We're going to be tweeting updates during the debate. And, of course, there is the live broadcast on our Facebook page. Just follow us at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, a U.S. prosecutor that took on top narco traffickers in the years of the Cocaine Cowboys. It's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, decades ago, Miami was at the epicenter of the U.S. war on drugs. Miami-Dade recorded over 600 murders in 1981. Compare that to just 231 in 2016. The high murder rate in the 1980s can, in part, be attributed to the drug wars taking the city by storm. In response, the federal government brought some of the top prosecutors from around the country down to Miami to rein in the violence. Among those tasked with that responsibility was Richard Gregory, who was prosecuting the mob in Boston. A Georgetown graduate and classmate of Bill Clinton, Gregory spent decades in the criminal justice system chasing after some of the key players in the cocaine trade. He was critical in the arrest of the Panamanian politician and military leader Manuel Noriega. Gregory recently retired from his post at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami. He joins us now in studio. Mr. Gregory, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me with you.
You know what? Give us a sense of what Miami was when you arrived in the early 1980s, because in a previous interview, you called it the Wild, Wild West.
Well, my favorite movie of all time is Casablanca, and to say that this was Casablanca is very accurate. It was filled with con artists and thieves, dope dealers, strong-arm artists, and just about every type of criminal that you could imagine were here, to say nothing of the espionage and spy traffic that came through Miami.
How would you describe, how large was the narcotics trade from Latin America relative to the mafia that you were dealing with in Boston?
Oh, it was massive compared to the mafia traffic. The mafia leaders were local, and they planned on staying here. The Colombians were trafficking cocaine and planning on running their money through here, but taking their money back out. There is no question that the cocaine trade, which I think in 1980 alone was about $11 billion, these are estimates, was just massive. And to this day, we still have massive amounts of drug capital flying through Miami.
Who were the big players when we talk about like the Colombian narcos or any of the narcos? Who were the big players at the time?
Well, the Pablo Escobar and the Ochoa family were the leaders. Of course, the development of the cartels is very interesting because I had started my career as a mafia prosecutor. And the Italian mafia had a definite hierarchy. The cartels were a little bit different. They were businessmen who pulled their assets together in order to improve the trade. So, for instance, Carlos Slater was in charge of transportation for the Medellin cartel. Pablo Escobar was in charge of political corruption and bribery. The Ochoa family was in charge of finances, and Gonzalo Rodriguez Gacha was in charge of the violence. And they divided up their responsibilities in that fashion instead of there being a strict hierarchy.
So what was the strategy when you're talking about trying to prosecute these folks? And were you just dealing with the folks that you can get here in Miami, in the United States? I mean, what was the overall strategy and how you were battling this?
Well, this is really interesting because when I came here in 1982, there was a new U.S. attorney brought in, a fellow named Stanley Marcus. And this U.S. attorney didn't come from the local political spectrum, which is the usual way U.S. attorneys come. He was chosen from out of the Department of Justice. He had been an assistant in the Eastern District of New York, and he had been head of the Criminal Organized Crime Strike Force in Detroit. And so he wasn't even a member of the bar here in Florida. He was brought in for the sole purpose of organizing an office that was going to go after the highest traffickers in the world. And when he brought me down here, I came as head of the Strike Force Field Office in Connecticut. He told me he wanted me to go after the highest level criminals that I could find. And don't worry about the politics. You take it to the highest level you can find, and he would deal with the Justice Department.
So the highest level, does that mean getting the guys who were in Colombia, or again, just only what you can get here?
Absolutely. No, it included getting the guys in Colombia or wherever the evidence took us. There was no limit on where the evidence would take us. And what's interesting is Miami, even back then, was the epicenter of traffic between South America, Europe, and the United States. So we here in Miami, in the port of Miami, at the Miami airport, I think in 1982, there was a 4,000-pound seizure of cocaine at the Miami International Airport. I mean, this is the kind of traffic you're talking about. We had boats of every size and shape bringing dope up to the coast and dropping it off in the water here. You know, we had massive seizures of dope all up and down the waterways.
How much did you depend on informants?
They're absolutely essential. You cannot take a case from a street buy to the next level without having a cooperating individual or an informant. They're necessary to any case.
How do you get somebody who's working within the system to turn on that system? How do you get a guy who's, you know, he's working for one of these cartels, but you've got to get him to play both sides so you could use him to get some of these upper-level criminals?
Well, I'm going to talk about two of the most significant individuals who cooperated with me. First, there was Barry Seal. And Barry Seal was a pilot. He had worked, it was clear he had worked for the intelligence agencies at some point. But Barry was an adventure freak. He loved the excitement of doing what he was doing. So when he was caught and being threatened with going to jail for 10 years, it occurred to him that he could help himself out and continue the excitement of doing what he was doing by cooperating with law enforcement, which is what he did. Unfortunately, you know, he refused to go into a witness protection program and get out of that lifestyle. He absolutely refused, and as a result, he got killed. And about a month after he was killed, the second type of informant showed up, and that was Max Mermelstein. Max Mermelstein was a brilliant guy. He was an engineer. And I remember my first trip to go see him out in the jail in Los Angeles. And he told me the first time I saw him that he was a Mensis, that he was brilliant, much smarter than I was. And I looked around the prison cell that we were in, and I said, Max, you don't look too smart here. So this was the second type of individual who was greedy and looking for a way out of jail. Faced with really heavy prosecution, they would turn.
What did both of these guys help you achieve?
First, Barry Seal was the first real witness to come forward and identify the leadership of the cartels. He flew planes for them. He had met them. He didn't speak Spanish, which was interesting. But he described to us a setup where he would go down to Colombia and they would have meetings with all the pilots who were flying dope. And they would arrange for loads that were shared. Each kilo had a marking on it. So if it was an Ochoa, it would have an 8 on it. If it was somebody else's, it would have a different marking on it. And how they even insured the load. So if it was taken off by law enforcement or the plane crashed, there was actually insurance for cocaine loads.
Wait a minute. Who was insuring cocaine loads?
They actually had financial backers who would insure the loads. They would pay them a fee to insure the loads, and if the load got taken off, that load would be repaid for. So they had a really complex system that was developed from the mid-70s to the early 80s. This whole system developed, and you'd have to give them credit for putting this together. And there were really two separate organizations. There was the Medellin cartel, which went through Florida and New York, and the Cali cartel, which went through California and had connections in New York as well. So those two were sort of in competition, but worked together from time to time.
I loved reading back a lot of the stories of the trade, the drug trade here in Miami in the 80s, and it wasn't sophisticated. And some of the stories I'd read of people, the way they laundered their money, the way they were trying to move their money around, was almost hilarious. It was just kind of ridiculous.
We had an organization called Operation Greenback. And as chief of narcotics here, I was also in charge of Operation Greenback. So it was a group of agents who were both IRS and customs. And their sole job was to interrupt the financial traffic. And I remember one day of them stopping a fellow named Emiliano Rodriguez flying a plane out of Miami. He was a money launderer for Pablo Escobar. And he was taking off with his plane, and the agents rolled out on the runway, stood right in front of the plane and blocked the plane from taking off. One of the agents stood there with a shotgun. Unfortunately, it wasn't even loaded. Emiliano Rodriguez stopped the plane on the spot, and they emptied the plane. He had $5 million in cash. And I remember them taking it back to the Greenback offices, which were on the top floor of a warehouse. And here you have agents making maybe $30,000 a year at the time, which would have been a lot. And they were counting $5 million in cash. And they were counting it with money machines that had been seized from other money laundering experts. Another little story which you'll find amusing is we had one agent who was really good at seizing money. And he would go to a house identified as a place that was being used to store dope or money. And he would knock on the door. And, of course, they would have Colombians who were there for 6 months at a time responsible for these places. And he would say, I'm a federal agent. I want to come in and look around. Do you mind? And of course, the Colombian would back right off. And he'd go in, and there'd be money everywhere. And he'd ask the man, whose money is this? And the man would say, I don't know. I have no idea. Okay, I'm going to take it. And they would just seize the money and walk off with it. And amazingly enough, nobody ever claimed it. Nobody ever came in to claim this money. And literally, we had millions of dollars on the floor of Operation Greenback on various days.
We're talking with Richard Gregory. He spent decades in the criminal justice system taking on some of the key players in the cocaine trade back in the 80s here in Miami, actually for many years. He was essential also to the arrest of the Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega in the late 1980s. He is retired now. He actually retired not barely a little over a week ago. Let's talk about Noriega. This really one of the biggest busts for you. Significant because it was controversial over the extradition and the arrest of Noriega. Remind us of his significance during the drug war. What role was he playing?
Well, information came at first as a result of a seizure of a plane that landed up on I-75. The plane actually landed and crashed, and the pilot of that plane was eventually caught, and we extradited back here, was a fellow who flew for Noriega. And so he provided the information that Noriega was directly involved. But more importantly, prior to that, Max Mermelstein had told us about how Noriega was protecting the loads that went through. It was really fascinating to hear Max talk about Noriega, because he was for rent, not for sale. He wouldn't sell out. He was just renting his services. And so if you rented his services one day, that was fine. If you didn't pay him rent the next day, he'd give you up in a minute. And so this caused him a great deal of problems. In fact, there's a very famous photo that was provided by a witness later in the Noriega case of Fidel Castro meeting with one of Noriega's assistants regarding saving Noriega because he had cheated the cartel.
How long did it take for you to set up your indictment of Noriega?
It took us about 2 years to put it together. I mean, we had the pilot who had crashed the plane who was cooperating with us, but one cooperating witness is certainly not enough. So we had to develop quite a bit more.
And how was it decided that you were going to go into Panama and pull him out?
That decision was made much higher up the line. In fact, when we went to indict the case, there was a great deal of resistance to our indicting it. One of the issues that kept me from remaining here, I left in 1989 and came back in 1991, was my testimony before the U.S. Senate which caused a lot of consternation because I made it clear that there was no coordination between the intelligence community and the criminal law enforcement community. We were working on the one hand to take down the largest dope dealers in the world, and they on the other hand were using some of those dope dealers to fight, as we referred to it back then, the godless communist conspiracy.
Let's come back to today. And what I find interesting is that the drug trade, all of this stuff, it's still going on. But obviously Miami is not that city. I mean, there was the famous Time magazine, you know, Paradise Lost in Miami. It's, as you described it, the Wild Wild West, not the same city. But all that is still going on. It's still happening. You say because, well, they're a lot more sophisticated.
Oh, they have gotten far more sophisticated. The money laundering now goes through offshore banks. If you take a look around Miami, I ask you to go outside and take a look. There is still no industrial base here. We have no great Google isn't moving in. You aren't seeing some great industrial base. But there are massive buildings going up. And the condominiums for sale in those buildings, no average citizen in Miami is going to be able to afford those. So where is all the money coming from to put up these massive skyscrapers? The amount of money coming through Miami has no financial base. And it's really frightening because at some point, if the economy fails, then that's all going to come apart at the seams.
So still to this point, you're saying still to this point, drug money is still driving a lot.
Oh, absolutely. This is a major hub for drug transactions. In fact, the drug trade has changed a little bit lately. The southwest border, which was the major crossing point for the Mexicans who took over from the Colombians, they've now transferred back to boats. You know, they transfer with law enforcement, and they're always a step ahead of us. We now have massive shipments of cocaine in vessels, and we are seeing a major uptick in the amount of dope which is being caught on the high seas. And it's very tricky prosecutions, and it's got to take a lot of coordination.
So we talk about prosecuting and trying to fight this. President Trump recently announced his nominee for the U.S. District Court of Appeals in South Florida, Arianna Fajardo Orshan. She would be the first woman to hold the post, by the way, in South Florida history. What do you know about her background? What do you think about that nominee for that post?
Well,
what she could do.
I have to correct you on one thing. She wouldn't be the first woman. There actually was a woman U.S. attorney 30 or 40 years ago. I'd have to go
in
back
South Florida.
In South Florida.
I'll check on that. Okay.
But you can check on that. Here is what I would have to say. You know, when I came here, they brought a U.S. attorney in from the Justice Department. You have to know how the Justice Department works. This is a district which deals with numerous other districts, with numerous other countries. We have Venezuelan officials under indictment waiting to be captured. If you've never handled a federal case, and I don't know this lady at all. I've been here now since 1982, and I've never met her, so I can't comment one way or another on her, other than to tell you that she's never been in the federal system. And to come into a district like this and try to take it over, I've got to ask, what is the qualifications to do that? How are you judging somebody to come in and run an office of 230 federal prosecutors that covers not just Dade County, it covers everything from Fort Pierce down to Key West. And those 230 prosecutors have some of the most complex prosecutions in the country.
Let me ask you this as we finish up. The drug war today, I mean, how do you describe it? And really, I mean, we've been at this for decades. Are we doing anything the right way? Are we accomplishing anything? Or is this just going to be an endless fight?
Well, it is like saying, will we ever stop murder or robbery? I mean, where there is a market for the sale of illicit drugs, there is always going to be a problem. The question is, you know, how are we dealing with the addiction? And we're having a major problem now with addictive drugs of a different sort,
but like meth
painkillers. But the question is, how are we dealing with it?
And as you said, they're more sophisticated. The systems that criminal organizations are using for especially money laundering are more sophisticated. Are we keeping up with them? Are we able to stay ahead of them in any way?
This is a very, very difficult question, because the actual amount of money in the market is very difficult. And now we're even running into the new currency, Bitcoin, the whole currency market that is unregulated and out there is taking over, and the criminals are always seem to be one step ahead of us. So I would have to tell you that are we making progress in that area? It's very difficult. On the other hand, should we quit? Absolutely not.
Richard Gregory, again, former U.S. attorney here in South Florida, who went after some of the biggest narcos in Colombia, also went after former dictator Manuel Noriega. He is now retired. Great stories that we got to hear from him about what Miami was, and obviously he's saying, hey, still is, just a different kind of world. Mr. Gregory, it's such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And enjoy that retirement.
Thank you. I will.
All right, still to come, we look back on the Pulse nightclub shooting through the lens of a new documentary. That's next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, tomorrow marks 2 years since the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando, where 49 people were shot and killed. There are now two ongoing lawsuits related to the massacre filed by victims' families and survivors. There's one against the Orlando Police Department claiming they could have done more to stop the shooter, another one against the nightclub for inadequate security. Tomorrow night, a new documentary telling the stories of the survivors and the victims will be screening in Fort Lauderdale. It's called 49 Pulses, produced and directed by filmmaker Charlie Men. It will play at the Classic Gateway and Saver Cinema Theaters at 7 and 9, respectively. Men has focused much of his filmmaking career telling the stories of victims of violence, from the Las Vegas massacre to his ongoing project on the Parkland shooting. And he joins me now in studio. Mr. Men, thank you so much for the time.
You're very welcome.
What stories were you looking to tell in this project that weren't being already told by the mainstream media?
Stories of guts, heroism, and humanity. I'm sick and tired of the focus being put on the killer. I think it creates copycats. And I've always said, if you ask the average person who follows the news, for instance, in the Pulse case, can you name the Pulse nightclub shooter? They probably go one for one. If the next question is, can you name one out of the 49 murdered victims? Chances are they go zero for 49. So I'm trying to change that dialogue.
Do you think that, and this is a conversation that's popped up, obviously, with the Parkland shooting, discussions about whether we should even say the perpetrator's name?
Not at all. I mean, in the Parkland case, the cell phone video that came out of the killer saying what he was going to do, I mean, that's disgraceful. What do we gain as a society from that? It just creates copycats. And the killer in Parkland even admitted he doing this for attention. And guess what? The shameless media gives it to him. It's an absolute disgrace.
How did you find the people for these stories? Were they willing to open up and share?
Yeah, we've done 10 interviews, Louis, just in the last 24 hours. Teachers, survivors, but the people I'm really focusing in on were the people inside the 1200 building. I think we haven't heard from them enough. We've heard from other people, but they were not at the war zone, if you will. They were not at the scene. So these are direct, firsthand eyewitness accounts of people that literally got shot or missed getting shot by inches.
And you're talking right now about Parkland.
Correct.
Because you're putting that project together.
Yeah, Parkland right now. The Pulse nightclub shooting, we did that a year ago. And I'm happy to bring it to Fort Lauderdale to represent and honor those victims from Pulse inside the gay nightclub. And the two-year anniversary is tomorrow.
Yeah. One of the people you talked to for your Pulse film, Chris Hansen, he was one of the survivors of the shooting. He had a very interesting perspective on Orlando. This is from the beginning of the film.
I told myself, I'm like, wow, I came to Orlando to settle roots. So I've been all over the country traveling. I really wanted Orlando to be my home. I told my dad, hey, I'm going to find that community you wanted. It's going to happen here. It's going to happen.
What did the survivors tell you about the LGBT community in Orlando that made it so unique?
I mean, I don't think it's as big as Fort Lauderdale. But there's certainly a community for LGBTQ in Orlando. It's a very diverse city. There's a lot of people. And a lot of the community was cheated that day. I mean, this was Latino night at that gay nightclub. People don't tend to talk about that either. This was an attack on gay Latinos. I need to be specific here because it was Latino night. So the Puerto Rican community, which has really been hit hard recently with all the natural disasters, and now if you throw the Pulse nightclub shooting in there, it's been a very, very tough time for them.
You know, throughout the film, you bring in cell phone video that was capturing events of the shooting as it was happening, things like that. But you see what social media, what role it plays, the technology that we use, how it plays in how these stories kind of really now find that extra space out there in the world beyond what just the regular media is doing. But how would you say that when you look at shootings throughout the years, how social media has kind of changed the conversation?
Well, now, I mean, there's just so many different ways we can view what happened. I mean, it's not just the media, but people that can literally whip out a phone and they're right there. So I think more people tend to look at those things because that's right in the line of fire. You're right in the moment. It's almost as if you're taken there. The media who were not there at the time, you know, they're getting it third hand. So, I mean, today with modern technology, we can find out something in more in depth and more quickly.
You talked to law enforcement for this film, but how open were they considering there's a lawsuit against them? And sometimes they tend to be quiet.
Orlando PD would not talk to me. So I was lucky. I got something from Eatonville, which is literally a suburb of Orlando. So the officer, I went through the PIO, of course, and he was allowed to talk to me. He was a first responder. He was there for the whole ordeal. This took over 3 hours for police to take down the shooter. So I'm not surprised that the victims are suing the Orlando PD. 13 innocent people bled out in the bathroom. Think about that. I mean, the police knew that they were trapped in the bathroom bleeding out, and yet they took a tactical position and were outside when the shooter was inside mowing down people. So Columbine was supposed to change the tactics from SWAT. You're supposed to go in and get the shooter, like Mr. Israel said from the Broward County Sheriff's Office. That's why Scott Peterson was criticized harshly for not going in, and he had to resign. So I don't know why SWAT didn't go in the Orlando case when the model had changed because of Columbine.
Many of the survivors that you talked to expressed a sense of guilt over how they responded. This is Chris Littlestar, one of the survivors that you also talked to.
I ended up running for cover in the men's bathroom in the handicap stall. Ended up getting into the stall last, but I kind of like pushed everybody out of my way and made it all the way into the very far corner of the stall. I definitely have, you know, regrets like maneuvering through all those people just to get myself safe. I mean, I think about it all the time.
How do you get survivors to go back? Because to share that story, and I know when I interview people, it's difficult because you're asking them to go back into that moment. And that can be very painful.
Absolutely. Every victim has their own way of dealing with a tragedy. And some will talk about it. Some will never talk about it. And I totally understand their feelings. If they don't want to be in the film, no problem whatsoever. But, Louis, some people want to talk. It's their way of healing. Some people want to share their story. It's therapeutic for them. So in Pulse, we had a lot of people open up. And the Parkland film that I'm working on, this happened just 4 months ago. I've already interviewed 10 people, and that list is growing. So it really depends on the victim.
What do you want people who are going to see this film to walk away from? I mean, this is 2 years now removed from Pulse, and we've had how many shootings since? I mean, we had Las Vegas, Parkland, and still more. But
Santa Fe.
Yeah. I mean, what do you want them to take away from this?
Well, I just think all the focus should be on the victims and their stories. I mean, at the end, documentaries are meant to inform, educate, and raise awareness for social change. And I'm here to change that dialogue where we just cannot name the killer ever again when we report murders. This is just my humble opinion. I think that would prevent murders of innocent people in our country moving forward, because now killers would know going in that their name will never be mentioned again. It's worth a try. And I've always thought in some way the media indirectly causes these mass murders because they want that attention. The Boston Marathon bomber was placed on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. That's a disgrace. And the Orlando shooter said he looked up to the Boston Marathon bomber. So if Rolling Stone magazine had not done that, would the Orlando tragedy inside Pulse have even occurred? It's a valid question.
So then, you know, and just to mention too, I want to say that, you know, as WLRN, we've covered this issue with Parkland. We've talked to the students, we've talked to parents and so forth. On that particular issue, by the way, as you mentioned earlier, with the shooter's video out, we didn't post that video. Though we did talk to people about what the video entailed and what the shooter was trying to do. This goes back a long ways. I mean, people wanting to gain that fame. But do you think that, not saying the name, do you think that there's ever going to be a time, is that enough to stop these kind of things from happening? Because as look, from Pulse, how many have we had since? And it seems like it's just not stopped.
I don't think that's the only, if we don't mention the killer's name ever again, I don't think that's going to, we need more. I mean, look at mental illness, of course, gun control, security at schools. I mean, there's a lot of factors here. It's not just one thing.
Is there anything you're doing differently in the Parkland film that you're putting together, what you did with Pulse?
We just started shooting yesterday, so it's still developing. Films evolve over time. The interviewees certainly have a great effect on the direction of the film. Sometimes you come up with and create new angles because of a topic that came up unexpectedly.
Do you have a date when you expect
In the fall.
In the fall.
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be playing in maybe two or three theaters in Fort Lauderdale. And most of my films are on Amazon Prime. And the website for this film is 49pulses.com. That will give you all the screening information. And I was given a one-week run, actually, at Gateway starting on Friday as well.
Okay. Charlie Minn, again, his new film is called 49 Pulses. And it is playing at the Classic Gateway and Saver Cinema Theaters at 7 and 9 o'clock, respectively. Again, we're 2 years out from the Pulse.
Tomorrow, yeah.
Tomorrow. So, Charlie, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And we'll have more information on our website, WLRN.org, so you can learn more about his films. And again, this particular film that he has just put out. Well, that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.